And now it's time for On Our Minds. And speaking of time, this week Ruth Ozeki's award-winning novel A Tale for the Time Being is just out in paper. The story begins when a writer finds a school lunchbox washed up on a beach. Inside is a diary written by a Japanese teenager named Nao. Here's how the book opens.
Hi. My name is Nao, and I'm a time being. Do you know what a time being is? Well, if you give me a moment, I will tell you. A time being is someone who lives in time, and that means you and me and every one of us who is or was or ever will be. As for me, right now, I'm sitting in a French maid cafe in Akiba Electricity Town, listening to a sad chanson that's playing sometime in your past, which is also my present, writing this and wondering about you, somewhere in my future. And if you're reading this, then maybe by now you're wondering about me too. You wonder about me. I wonder about you.
Ruth, this character now has such a vibrant, distinctive voice when she really kind of jumps off the page from the very beginning. How did she come to be?
You know, at the time, I guess it was probably 2004, 2005, I was studying the fascicles, the essays of a 13th century Zen master named Dogen Zenji. And he'd written an essay called Uji, which can be translated as time being or being time or for the time being. But for some reason, every time I was reading this essay, I kept reading time being as in like time being, like human being, right? And this phrase just kind of stayed in my mind and somehow just translated itself into the voice of this 16-year-old Japanese schoolgirl, Nao Yasutani.
So tell us about Nao. How would you describe her to someone who hasn't met her?
Well, I guess I would describe her as a displaced. She is a Japanese girl born in Japan, but was raised in Silicon Valley in Sunnyvale, California. And the family was forced to move back to Tokyo, where she was put into a junior high school and, you know, had none of the cultural fluency. You know, she didn't have money for nice stuff, and she just didn't really know how to relate to the other kids. And so she is being very badly bullied. And she decides that she's going to kill herself. But before she does, she wants to do one last act of redemption, which is to tell the fascinating life story of her 104-year-old great-grandmother, who is a Zen Buddhist nun.
Wow. Now, you are also yourself a Zen Buddhist priest. I think you were ordained in 2010.
That's right.
Are there elements of Zen Buddhist philosophy that you wanted to explore or embed in this novel, particular elements?
Well, I think that more than that, it's kind of the other way around. In the years prior to writing this novel, I was practicing Zen Buddhism very seriously. And I was doing a lot of meditating and a lot of study of Zen philosophy. And I think the book really grew out of that. It wasn't so much that I wanted to embed Zen philosophy in the book, but it was more
the novel embedded itself in your practice.
Exactly, exactly. And in a way, the novel is an expression of that practice.
In what way?
You know, I guess the way I like to think about it is in a sense, you know, the book is a performance of certain Zen philosophies, certain Zen propositions. For example, you know, Zen teachings on time and impermanence, or Zen teachings on interconnectedness, what is called in Buddhism dependent co-arising, the way that we are never separate from each other. You know, there's no separation between self and other. And I think that all of these, you know, these kinds of philosophical propositions, if you read the book with those in mind, you can see how the book kind of enacts those.
But you're suggesting, aren't you, also that our notion of self or of having an independent self in the real world is something of a myth, an illusion.
It is an illusion. Yes, exactly. That's exactly right. I mean, there's no way to be an independent self, is there? How could you possibly be an independent self? I mean, we come from somewhere. We come from our mothers and our fathers. You know, we can't survive. We can't survive for a minute without others around us. In Buddhism, it's often looked at as, you know, we're like waves in the ocean. We rise up from the ocean and appear very briefly as a little white, you know, speck, piece of foam in the water, but then we subside again into the larger ocean. And we're time beings in that sense. You know, we rise out of time and then we fall back into time.
Or I was going to say, another way of putting it is we're all ghosts.
Yes, or we're all ghosts, exactly.
Yeah, there exactly. And there are some real ghosts in this book. Also, Nao meets the ghost of
Haruki. Yes, that's right. Her great uncle, Haruki number one. That's right.
So I'm curious. Western culture, of course, has this long history of ghost lore and ghost stories, but the notion of ghosts in Japanese culture, and especially in Zen Buddhist culture, I think, is somewhat different.
That's right. I mean, my grandmother, for example, always kept a small shrine, a small altar in her house, no matter where she went. And every day she would wake up in the morning and she would boil hot water for tea. And she would bring a cup of hot water to the altar and give it to my grandfather, who had been dead for many years. But this was her ritual. And in a sense, it kept him there. It kept him, you know, alive and present in her life. In Japanese culture, the ancestors are never, never far away. They live just on the other side, and they visit frequently. I mean, certainly once a year, there's a wonderful festival called Obon, which appears in the book as well. But it's a bit like the Mexican Day of the Dead, where the ancestors come back to visit the living.
I read an interview with you recently in which you referred to a Japanese word or concept, kotodama, which means something like the spirit in words. I don't know much about the concept, but it made me wonder, can words sort of have ghosts?
Well, I think they are ghosts. Words are ghosts. Language is a ghostly kind of ritual that we perform. We've inherited language from the dead, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, every time we speak words, we are actually speaking the language of the dead, the tongues of the dead. So, you know, in that sense, I think language is ghostly.
That makes me wonder whether writing as a form of Zen practice for you, or vice versa, I guess, how the two inform each other.
The two are very, very close to the point where I would almost say at this point they are expressions of each other. How's that? You know, I've been meditating for many years, and I find that the relationship between the two practices really is very intimate and mutually supportive. You know, they're both contemplative practices. They both require a kind of a tuning in to the mind in a particular kind of way. They're wonderfully supportive of each other.
And circling back to that theme of time, they both seem to me to be practices that are part of an effort to change our relationship to time or change our perception of time.
That's a wonderful thought, because I think, you know, one of the things that meditation teaches you, you could actually say that meditation is a way of practicing patience. It's a way of learning to wait for nothing. And and this is very, very useful for a novel writer. You know, as Nao points out in the book, you know, it's very difficult to keep up with the mind. You know, as a writer, it's very difficult to kind of keep up with the mind. And you always feel like you're just lagging behind slightly. But I think that once something has been written, then we can look at that and we can think, yes, that is an expression of a moment in time. And so in a way, a book is a time capsule. Hmm. And, you know, it reminds me, too, of the ancient Greeks used to believe that when you recited the poems of a dead poet, it was actually the dead poet who was borrowing your tongue in order to make himself or herself understood.
Hmm. Well, this would be a great way to ask you to, for one more reading as we close, there's a scene when Nao meets the ghost of her long-dead uncle who was a kamikaze pilot. Would you read that scene for us?
Okay. So in this scene, Nao is visiting her great-grandmother at her Zen temple on the mountainside. And at night, she's been visited by the ghost of her great-uncle. And her uncle wasn't terribly conversational, and she didn't really have much to say to him. And so, and she was taken by surprise, so she sings a song to him, Le Mal de Vivre, a French chanson. And in this scene, she's chastising herself. Stupid Nao, what a foolish girl. There I was sitting with the ghost of my dead great-uncle, who just happened to be a kamikaze fighter pilot in World War II, and who was probably the most fascinating person I will ever get to meet. And what did I do? Sing some stupid French chanson to him? What is wrong with me? I could have asked him about all sorts of things. I could have asked him about his interests and his hobbies. I could have asked him if only depressed people cared about philosophy, and if reading philosophy books ever helped.
I could have asked him about what it felt like to be ripped from his happy life and forced to become a suicide bomber, and if the other guys in his unit picked on him because he wrote French poetry. I could have asked him how he felt when he woke up on the morning of his mission, which was also his last morning on Earth. Did he have a big cold fish dying in the hollow of his stomach? Or was he filled with a luminous calm that emanated from him so that everyone around him stood back in awe, knowing that he was ready to take to the sky? I could have asked him what it felt like to die. Stupid. Baka nao yastani.
Ruth Ozeki's novel, A Tale for the Time Being, was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize this year, and it's just out in paper.